We can consider the pursuit of pleasure in two broad senses, one which might be called lower and the other which might be called higher. Although I'm not very happy with that classification. There is the pursuit of material pleasure, an art very much neglected in this day and age, because it must be carefully distinguished from the pursuit of theoretical pleasure. The pursuit of material pleasure is an art requiring a difficult discipline, much devotion and much skill. And it ranges through all the activities of man, engineering, cookery, clothes, architecture, lovemaking, and the so-called fine arts, music, literature, painting, sculpture, and so forth. But we are living in a culture where the pursuit of material pleasure is, as I say, neglected in pursuit of a symbolic pleasure, which, of course, like many religions, has its prayer mat. Because a monetary unit is, of course, useful in exactly the same way that inches and hours, days, months, pounds, grams, and other units of measure are useful. But nobody has yet made a claim to fame by collecting inches. I have more inches than you. Because it is not a matter of social agreement that the possession of inches represents the possession of wealth. It is a matter of social agreement, and this is the only validity for money having any value whatsoever, is that everybody agrees that the chips are worth so much. And money is exactly like poker chips, except there's an agreement between all of us that we will accept them in lieu of goods and services. But goods and services constitute real wealth. And we are living in a society where we eat the menu instead of the dinner, because we are more interested in accumulating the tokens of wealth than wealth. And this flows over from symbols such as money itself into many other dimensions of life, because we tend on the whole to confuse symbol with reality. The idea that this world that we see with our five senses is a material world is merely an idea. Materialism as a philosophy of nature, dialectical materialism, naturalistic materialism, is a point of view. It's a concept. It's a very, very highly abstract notion. So equally is the notion that this world that we see with our five senses is basically mental or spiritual. That also is a concept. The actual world is neither spiritual nor material. There is no way of saying what it is, because it is, like mystical experience, ineffable. It cannot be effed or spoken, from the Greek phimi, to say. So, that world which is neither spiritual nor material is the neglected world. Most people think of it as material, but it's very much overlooked. Symbols are substituted for it. That is to say, we have symbolic goods. People live in symbolic homes, drive symbolic automobiles, wear symbolic clothes, which are valued for what they cost rather than for their quality. And this is, of course, as I've insisted, perhaps ad nauseam, especially manifested in what we eat. Our standards of cooking are improving, thanks to Gourmet magazine and a few redoubtable people on the radio, like Julia Childs. But by and large, the food of even wealthy people is disgraceful. It is symbolized by bread, which is supposed to be our staff of life, and we eat nothing but a kind of consumable styrofoam, fortified with vitamins, and you can read the list of them on the wrapper as if it were medicine. Also, in the pursuit of pleasure in the form of the fine arts, we don't really enjoy it. An enormous number of reasonably affluent people who attend concerts and go to exhibitions of paintings go there because they think they're improving their minds. That in some way doing things like that is good for you. People go to church for the same reason. That's the last reason for going to church, because it's good for you. That is an absolutely morbid interest, because it distracts you from what is going on. If you listen to Bach because you think it's good for you, you are not listening. In order to listen to Bach, you have to swing with it. And then you forget all about whether it's good for you or not. In fact, it feels more like things that are bad for you. When you swing with Bach, it begins to feel like sex. And as everybody knows, that's terribly bad for you. So I'm not going to dwell at any very great length on the niceties and the disciplines of the pursuit of pleasure in that so-called lower sense. I only want to say in passing that if you don't have the realization that the pursuit of material pleasure requires a certain degree of asceticism, you won't be able to pursue any other or higher kind of pleasure. Because asceticism is not unpleasant. Asceticism is like an olive between wines. It cleanses the palate. And what's the matter with olives? It is like taking some sort of exercise, which can be very pleasurable indeed, provided you don't do it grimly. There is a dreadful exercise being used today called jogging, which has absolutely nothing to recommend it. Because to begin with, when I watch people jogging, they obviously show they don't know how to run. They're running mostly on their heels. And that jars the bones all the way through and upsets the vertebral discs and so on. And there's a certain grim determination about joggers. They tend to run in straight lines, which they believe to be the shortest distance between two points. Now, a straight line is not the shortest distance between two points on Earth, because Earth is wiggly. It is not a flat surface, except by courtesy of bulldozers and occasional freaks of nature. This world, as I keep repeating, is a fundamentally wiggly phenomenon. But wherever human beings have been around, you will see they have a passion for Euclideanism. Everything is ruled out in straight lines and put in boxes, and grid patterns of streets are laid across the surface of the earth. And that tells you human beings have been there. Why this passion for Euclidean order? Because Mr. Euclid had a very, very simple mind and tended to think in these rather uninteresting shapes instead of in curvaceous wiggles. Now, nobody would fall in love with a Euclidean woman. What we appreciate about women is their curvaceousness, their wiggliness. And wiggliness offends some people because they are not sure of it. They can't figure it out. You never know quite what it's going to do next. That's why people often don't like snakes, because a snake is the great symbol of wiggly vitality, of undulation, of waves. And all this world is fundamentally a system of wave vibrations. And if you cannot wave with it, if you are rigid, you will always be resisting life. So wiggliness and going with wiggliness, in other words, do you swing, is fundamental to the pleasure of life. But you see, where we think that order and getting things in order is getting them squared away. We're always saying, let's get it squared away. Let's get it straight. And so there are certain kinds of people who are called straights and squares. Who do not swing. And as a result of that, they are out of harmony with a wiggly universe. And their attitudes range from cookery at one end to religion at the other. Because a square religion is one that is too abstract, that resists the flow element of life. It wants a canal instead of a river. And it conceives heaven as a city rather than a rose garden. Paradise is a garden. And all the trouble began when people substituted the heavenly city for the paradise garden. When, in other words, popes began to be called urban, and unbelievers were called pagan, because a paganus is a country dweller, a man of the wiggles, as distinct from a man of the streets. A liver under the sky, instead of one who lives in a box. Because the box, you see, is the great symbol of classification. What box are you in? All words are labels on intellectual boxes. Is it animal? Is it vegetable? Is it mineral? Three boxes. Is it solid or is it a gas? Is it Republican or is it Democrat? Is it capitalist or is it communist? Is it Christian or is it heathen? Is it male or is it female? All boxes. And so because we think in boxes, we live in boxes, all made out of ticky-tacky, and they all look just the same. And whereas certain kinds of fish live in beautiful shells, glorious spirally wiggles on them and lovely colors. And but we tend to want everything straightened out, you see. And that rigidity is always in a fight with the surrounding fluidity. And so we are, as it were, landlubbers rather than men of the waves. And the British have always made a great thing about this, because they've always associated freedom with the ocean. Who are so free as the sons of the waves? And Britons never, never, never shall be slaves because of this seamanship. Now, we think, you see, of the sea as fluid and the land as solid. And nothing could be further from the truth, as you've all experienced recently in Southern California. The earth is not very solid. It flows. Where I live, in Sausalito, we have along the waterfront a lot of land that has been reclaimed. And not so long ago, they built a marina quite close to us, where they dredged out mud to make the marina, not realizing that land is liquid. Therefore, the land adjoining the water is sinking to fill up the hole made by excavating for the marina. People just don't think of things like that because they think of land as solid. And so in religion, we are seemingly looking for solids, for something upon which I can take my stand, for a firm foundation, for the rock of ages, or even, poor old Paul Tillich, for the ground of being. But we are not living in that sort of universe. We're living in a fluid universe in which the art of faith is not in taking one's stand, but in learning to swim. You don't cling to, you don't try to stand on water. By breathing and by a certain relaxation, you learn to trust the water to support you. This is even more true in flying in the air, gliding especially, or in sailing. In all those arts, there is an adaptation to the fluid. And that is the major thing that we have to learn if we want to survive as a species and survive happily. Nobody wants just to go on. One wants to go on in an elegant way. And even that passion for survival is something against pleasure. Because nothing ruins pleasure more than the anxiety to go on having it. More, more, more. Because that shows when you ask for more, more, more and have the anxiety to go on, that you're not having it now. That you always think it's coming. That you want jam tomorrow is more pleasing than jam today. And if we say of something that is useless, it has no future, that's the most awful thing you can say about it. I would rather say of something that's no good, it has no present. Not that it has no future. Because a future is merely a promise, in the same way as this symbol is merely a promise to pay. Promises, promises, promises. So, therefore, it is fundamental to pleasure that one learns to wiggle and not be stiff and rigid. As we would say, let go. Relax, that doesn't mean become droopy. Relax means to become supple. It also means to learn the strength of your weight, how to use weight. How to flow with gravity. Water, for example, always flows with gravity. And it wiggles. It takes the course of least resistance. And yet has tremendous strength. But we, in our white Anglo-Saxon Protestant ethical system, not to mention our Irish Catholic one, which is really the same thing, only a little bit more fancy and dressed up in lace, is to take the line of least resistance is considered cowardly and despicable. Go straight, kaflooing, right through, with a bulldozer ahead. Why go straight? Well, you've got to get there. Fastest way, shortest distance between 2 points. And I get back to jogging. That is not the right way to run. The right way to run is to dance. To dance across the countryside. And anyone who dances across the countryside will outwit and out-time the jogger. I don't know if any of you witnessed the World Cup in soccer last year on television. It was won by the Brazilian team. And I have never seen such soccer. That's not the way they taught us to play it in school. As the sports writer in the London Times put it, they danced their way to victory. Because the whole thing was like very fine basketball, where instead of being this sort of tough pushing to victory, they were lilting with the ball and the most incredible teamwork of subtle passing, bouncing it off almost any part of the body with the capacity to give it direction, with one's back, with one's shoulder, with one's hip, anything, head. It was a beautiful art and a magnificent spectacle. But you see, we are not taught to do things that way, because we are taught that life is serious and therefore must be done in an efficient way, but according to Euclidean ideas of efficiency. In ancient times, when people worked, they used to sing. Hardly anybody sings anymore, except at a performance of some kind or something like that. Imagine a bank teller singing as they were counting out the money. Oh, the king was in his counting house, counting out the money. 5, 10, and 20, 30, 40, 50. You know? Why not? What would happen if you were confronted by a singing bank teller? You would complain to the management and say, this is money, it's very serious. Nobody could sing about it. Everything will go wrong. Can you imagine a stockbroker's working song? I have seen people. I once had my shoe shined in a New York subway. That was a most extraordinary performance. And he was swinging. And imagine, supposing you were a bus driver. You know, most people, when they drive a bus and through city traffic, they are cursing and swearing and being angry and fighting the clock all the way through town. Well, it's a disaster. But imagine driving a bus with the idea that going from here to there, the point wasn't to get there, but the point was to go. And dancing that bus through the streets with a very, very skillfully accurate traffic dodging. And when you get to a stoplight and there's a jam, you play a little tune on the horn. Or you pass jokes to the cab driver near you. Or you play with the passengers. See, anything can be turned into juggling, into playing with balls. That's why we say, have a ball. So this bus driver is swinging through the streets. And he prides himself in the marvel of his terpsichorean art. But people don't do that. Because work is not supposed to be pleasant. Because you get paid for it. You're not supposed to get paid for enjoying yourself. See, that's what I do. But I think I'm smart. I talk to you not because I think I'm doing you any good, but because I like talking about these things. And if you pay me for it, then I make my living. It's as simple as that. So I'm a sort of philosophical entertainer. But that's the point, that the transformation of work is swinging it. And the curse of work that came in the story of Genesis, you see, work became a curse because the tree of knowledge was the knowledge not of good and evil in the ordinary sense, but of the advantageous and the disadvantageous. The words in Hebrew refer to the art of metallurgy. That's where the trouble begins. When we use technology to get there fast, and the faster we get there, the less worth is the place of arrival. Because you've eliminated the distance between. And that's what makes the difference between here and there. The distance. If you take it away, then there is the same as here. So there was no point going there. There's no point going from here to Honolulu. None whatever, it's the same place, to all intents and purposes. Certainly no point in going from Los Angeles to Tokyo. Well, I mean, there are a few nice little bars in Tokyo where you can get sushi. But you can get them in Los Angeles now because Tokyo's come to Los Angeles. It's practically the same place. And both have the same smog. The police in Tokyo wear gas masks when they're directing traffic. You know, crazy. Is this wealth? To have a $150,000 house in Beverly Hills and live in poison gas? Crazy. That's wealth. So, work then being regarded as a method of getting there effectively. A lot of businessmen imagine that they are practical people. They say, oh, I don't go in for philosophy and that kind of thing. I'm a practical man. I like to get things done. What? I mean, what is practical? Well, you made money. But that's not practical until you spend it, until you enjoy it. And it's very difficult to enjoy money. Money is a great responsibility. Besides, if you get lots of it, you're afraid somebody's going to take it away. It gives you the jitters. You know, lots of people think that if they had a little more money, their problems would be solved, and they get it, then they worry about their health. There's always something to worry about if you're the worrying kind. Always. And it can get worse instead of getting better. By achieving all those things you think will stop you worrying. So the first principle in, we could call it the art of pleasure, is you must swing. And that means, or at least it looks like, superficially, that you mustn't take anything seriously. You must realize that life is a form of dancing. And dancing is, of course, not serious, and that's why it's prohibited by Baptists and gloomy people of that kind. They don't approve of dancing. Even in the Catholic Church, you don't normally see priests dancing. I mean, it's not because it's sexy. You can dance without partners of the opposite sex. You can dance by yourself. But it's considered undignified. This was all started by one of David's wives when, I think her name was, it wasn't Bathsheba, I forget which one it was. Perhaps somebody remembers it better than I do. Anyway, he danced before the Ark of the Covenant. And she reproved him for being undignified. Because he didn't sit stiff and rigid. But what is the virtue in being stiff and rigid? As Lao Tzu said, man at his birth is supple and tender, but in death he is rigid and hard. Plants, when young, are juicy and soft, but when old they are brittle and dry. And thus suppleness and softness are the signs of life, but rigidity and hardness are the signs of death. I suppose some men confuse psychic rigidity with getting a hard-on, or at least substitute it for it, as they substitute guns, rocket ships, and other things of that kind to manifest a masculinity which isn't really there. But certainly women should uphold to us. I mean, the real secret of women's liberation is the liberated woman, the woman who is the human serpent, the wiggly one, the gentle one who has the power of water. And we should look to that, as Lao Tzu again said, the valley spirit does not die. The valley spirit, that is the spirit of the valley. That is the feminine as distinct from the mountain, which is the male. And so, while being a man, you should have a certain feminine element, because then you will become a universal channel. Hold to the masculine, yes. The mountain is necessary for there to be a valley. You can't have valleys without mountains. But unfortunately, the gorgeous music of Handel has prevented us from realizing the horror of that biblical passage. Every valley shall be exalted, and every mountain laid low, and the rough places made plain. Why, it's happening all over California. So, the feminine, in the sense of the lilting, the playful, the curvaceous, the soft, is the neglected principle by all us Euclideans. And it is the principle of life and of nature. But the problem that exists for rigid people, and we all get rigid in the sense of resistance, resistance to life, resistance to change, is how on earth do I stop that syndrome which makes me go uptight? How do I stop that? Because it's useless. Almost useless. And do you know that your basic sense of ego, of existing here, and of being I as distinct from all that, do you know, it is muscular tension of a certain kind. That is the physical basis of your sense of identity. It is, for example, you can try this experiment. Maybe we will just try it. It's the simplest thing to do. I just want you to look a little downwards at whatever view is just in front of your eyes. Just allow your eyes to rest on that. Just let the light, the color, play with your eyes, see? Just rest it, easy. Now, supposing I said, now, I want you to look hard at it, pay attention, to be totally attentive and aware of what is in front of you. So look hard. Now do that. Do whatever you would do if somebody told you to look hard. Now don't do it. Just see. Don't look. Now again, look hard. And now don't do it. So what's the difference between the two states? What did you do when you were looking hard that you didn't do when you were looking easy? Where? What? How do you tense your brain? What did you tense? What? Muscles around the eyes. Anything else?
Temples.
Temples, yes.
Narrowed your focus to one thing instead of...
Narrowed your focus, yes. That was a muscular action. You see? What? What? Where do you feel concentration?
Everywhere. Your whole body.
You all go tense. Tense all over. But you see, muscular tension in your jaw, in your focal muscles, has absolutely nothing to do with seeing. The focal muscles of the eyes, all they do is simply open or close the aperture, or move the lens in such a way that it becomes in focus. It doesn't need any effort to do that. In fact, the effort you make when you look hard distracts from your seeing accurately. But we are constantly making efforts to do everything we do. For example, to will something. We make all this absurd muscular straining. Grit your teeth. Doesn't help you to do anything. And all this accumulates as a constant strain between the eyes and here. And that's what you call eye. That sensation of totally unnecessary strain that exists all the time. That is the ego, the physical referent of the idea ego. Just that unnecessary strain, because that tells you you exist. Teacher, I'm trying. At least give me B for effort. And it doesn't work. So we could say psychic staring is the ego. That we feel as being the center of myself, which is opposed to and which is resisting all that is defined as not myself. And so that rigidity of holding against life so that I maintain my shape, my form, my place, all the time, that constant resistance makes you uptight and unable to swing through fear of what will happen if you let it wiggle. And so, therefore, a non-wiggly person is unadaptive in a wiggly world. And so you get these insectual, mechanical-like behavior patterns that have to go on, regularly, always the same, chug, 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 chug. And they're not adaptable. And it doesn't hold up as we watch, you see. It isn't holding up. The cracks are in the pavements. And, the grass comes through. We're squaring all the fish out of existence. Well, what will there be to eat? Somebody said we're going to be left with nothing but crows, crab grass, and inedible fish. So this is the, you may say it's a square world. But then you can always, not by preaching at people and condemning them, but by wooing them, you can get them to come off it. See, that's the thing that I've often said, that preaching is no good. Because on Sunday you go to church, and the preacher says, bah, 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 and lays down the law, law, law. In other words, he throws the book at you. Look at a church. The minister wears the same robes as the judge. He's got the book up there. And not only does he tell you what to do, he tells God what to do. And his endless talk fest goes on. And when you get to sing, you sing hymns. Well, hymns are religious nursery rhymes. They all have dreadful tunes and stupider words. And that's all the singing. Maybe the choir does an anthem. Nobody dances. And there's nothing mysterious going on. Except in the Catholic Church, and they're trying to get rid of it. And, translate the Mass into English so that everybody understands it and finds out, alas, what it meant after all. So, Sunday is supposed to be the day to swing. Is that God worked for 6 days and the seventh day rested. There's this time out. Time out from being rational and methodical and efficient. It's like a Mardi Gras. It's like the old meaning of an orgy. A carnival. You've got to be crazy. A little. Because if you're not crazy at regular intervals, you become insane. Because you're too rigid. You don't swing in the wind. And thus, so you're going to collapse. But again, the problem remains. For the rigid person, and we all have a rigidity, how on earth do we release it? Because I notice that people who undertake programs of de-rigidifying themselves, maybe psychoanalysis, it may be therapy of some other kind, it may be exercises, it may be sensory awareness training, it may be encounter groups, it may be yoga, all sorts of de-rigidifying processes are done in such a grim mood. I know, there's a book called You Must Relax. Because then people get into these things. They start playing games. You know, it's like people who retire and they think they're going to have fun. So they get on the golf course early in the morning. And instead of enjoying golf, which is entirely possible, they begin to think not in terms of athletics, but of mathletics. What is my score? See, they gamble on it. And that gives it the interest of the prayer mat, of the abstract aspect, you see. How much? What is my measure? Do I matter? That matter is the same as the word meter. See, measure. Do I matter? And so they get this religion of golf and are playing all sorts of social games tied in with it. See, it's very serious. Then when golf is over, they'll go to the bridge table. When they're completely worn out, they'll get vaguely drunk. And this grim pursuit of pleasure goes on. And the religious people do it too. They do their meditations. 40 minutes before breakfast.
Ah!
No? Meditate. Then they've got stages they can get through in it. And they wonder whether so-and-so is doing yoga with Mrs. X, and so-and-so is doing it with Swami B. And Mrs. X's followers are afraid that Swami is phony. And it's not quite the real thing. Well, how do you know whether he's the real thing or not? Well, the genuine swamis can perform magic. And they can remain undecomposed in forest lawn for an indefinite period without benefit of embalming. Crazy! You know, what does that prove? You see, it's the same old thing. That is spiritual technology. And the people who want power, who want to get there fast, I want results now. The same temperament that wants it in the management of the material world wants it in the management of the spiritual world. My yoga is more efficient than yours because it's faster. I'm going to get there. So we come to the great question. Where is there? You're going to get there. Where is it? What do you want? Where are you going? Very few people know. Some people have a precise, I would say disciplined, clear sense of what they want. And they get it. And then they stop. As G.K. Chesterton once wittily said, progress is looking for a place to stop. There are very few people like that. Most people, you see, when they think of pleasure, don't have any very definite idea. Or else they have a definite idea which isn't really what they wanted. And when they get it, they don't like it. So the saying, be careful of what you desire, you may get it. But fundamentally then, the question arises, where is there? Where's your rush? Where are you going? To what are you progressing? Stop, look, and listen. Because you may be there already. Only that you don't notice it. From the point of view of a starving Indian in a Calcutta slum, we are all as lucky as Maharajas. Even the most penurious person in this room is by comparison a Maharaja. You're there. You've arrived. But you say, it can't last. Eventually, I'm going to turn into a corpse. That gives you the horrors. Or you're going to take a painful route to that end. It'd be a terminal case in a hospital on the end of a lot of tubes. You say, oh, I don't want to disintegrate. So, how can I overcome that? So you turn to religion and say, well, that's a physical demise as an unfortunate limitation of the body. So I'm going to identify myself with something beyond the body so that I can believe that that will go on and that will be the true vehicle of my personality. I shan't lose all that I've acquired carrying around with me my bag of rubbish. I managed to smuggle it across the border. They say you can't take it with you. But you can if the guards can't notice it, because the baggage is spiritual. Hey, do you know what the gate of heaven is? Hear about the pearly gates? People think it's gates decorated with pearls. It isn't. The gate of heaven, it says in the book of Revelation, is one pearl. Of course, it's got a hole through for the string. You've got to get through there. And you can't get through if you've got a lot of baggage. So you've got to leave your past behind to get through. Now, what happens to you when you get rid of your past? Forget it all. Forget who you are. The future, of course, is the past reflected in your rear vision mirror. And as McLuhan says, he borrowed the metaphor from me, as a matter of fact, we like people driving looking at their rear vision mirror. So you've got to let go of all that past in order to get in through the pearly gate. And what is left of you when you let go your past? What remains? No, you can't bring out your education. Can't bring out your ancestry. Can't bring out your distinguished accomplishments, the things you've done, because they say, well, you've done all that, but let's see what you can do now. Where are you? Who are you when you have no past? After all, there isn't any past. Where is it? Twist your common sense around and see that you're not being shoved by the past, you're just leaving it behind like tracks. It's not pushing you unless you insist on it. You can always pass the buck. Everybody does that. They say, oh, I'm a neurotic mess because my mother was a neurotic mess. I never had a fair chance in life. And somebody says to your mother, well, you shouldn't have brought up a child like that. Well, she says, it's too bad, I know, but I couldn't help it. I was a neurotic mess, and my father was just appalling, and my mother was dreadful. And they look back over their shoulder and said, well, it was our parents. Everybody passes the buck to the past, till it gets back to Adam and Eve. And you know what happened there. They passed the buck too, to the serpent. When God looked at the serpent, he didn't ask, hast thou eaten the fruit of the tree whereof I told thee thou shouldst not eat? He just looked at the serpent. The serpent didn't say anything. So the serpent, the wiggle, it really doesn't have a past, because it wiggles from its head backwards to the tail. And it's always the head where it starts. So, are you a head? Or are you just a tail? Do you move backwards? Or forwards? Which way are you going? See, if you're leaving your past behind you, it doesn't drive you. It wells up out of a mysterious present, ever new. This moment is the creation of the universe. It's starting now. If you look back and back and wonder whether there was a big bang a long time ago, all you'll see is vanishing traces. The big bang is happening now. This is when the world begins. You're doing it. Only you're not doing it by straining. A you deeper than the straining you is doing all this. The same you that is growing your hair and coloring your eyes and making your thumbprints and all that. But you don't think about it. You don't strain muscles to do it. But that is what is creating the world. Here it comes. Now. So instead of thinking that the past is the reality which explains everything that happens now, let's look at now and see it happening. Where does it happen from? That's a question asked only by people who think that the past causes the present. They always want to know where it comes from. Who started it? What makes it happen? Supposing nothing makes it happen. Supposing it happens. Well, what is it that happens? Again, we get to this basic question. What is it that you want? Where is it? What are you looking for? It's the same question as what is reality? What is now? What is life? You won't get at it by analysis of all sorts of things into their components. You won't get it by labeling it in various ways and calling it names. You can only find out what it is by looking at it, by feeling it directly. And all kinds of classification where we say, well, it's animal, vegetable, mineral, it's this, that, and the other thing, is putting it in boxes and tidying it up. That's how you tidy up. You put everything away in a box. And then you have boxes inside boxes and all that sort of thing. It's tidied up. But when it's all put away in a boxes, you can't see it. Now, instead of putting everything in boxes, let's just look at it the way it comes. Now, that's enough to start with. I've therefore discussed the principle of the necessity of wiggling. Only when I say necessity, you mustn't take that word in a Calvinistic sense. We'll talk about the pleasure of wiggling as a means of adaptation to the wiggly world.